Okay.
I believe in the freedom of an individual to do what he or she believes in, so long as their action doesn't impede the right of other people's. That means other people's freedom to do other things. Because freedom has to be seen in the context where it is interdependent.
Yeah.
It is interrelated, right? If because I live here, I think that, okay, fine, I want to take the bulldozer and bulldoze my place and dump it down, that, you know, part of my yard and dump it down, yeah, this is going to affect my neighbor then. It is my right to bulldoze my yard, but it is still not my right to dump it in my neighbor's property. So, you know, if an individual decide that, look, I'm going to smoke and I'm going to sit out there and I'm going to smoke, I mean, that's the person's problem. Because all of us have our sins, our fault, no matter what way we want to look at it. That everybody else might not like. But so long as I keep my problem, you know, my bad ways to myself, and I don't impede other people with it, that's pretty much okay with me. It's pretty much okay.
Like marijuana, you don't like put a cream on your room and like I have to take a cigarette.
No. If I put something in the room, it's like if I have a cord or something like that, then
like an airflow.
I use something like honey and garlic, or with a little lime juice or lemon or whatever. That can work. If you put a little rum in it, you know. But I know people who, you know, who would put like, you know, the marijuana in the rum and
put out
fermenter with it and they use it for 19 pains and stuff like that. It's not that they're drinking it because that this green thing in this rum is not something that you can supposed to drink anyway. That's too potent. You know, so I know people who do that and people use marijuana for various things, you know. And marijuana just like any other drugs or something like that. Sometimes people say more about it, what it can do, more than what it can actually do. It's just the same like some other drug, somebody when you go to the pharmacy, that's how you prescribe something, you go to the pharmacy and you buy it, and you get a relief. But maybe because you went to the doctor and your mind is more contented, that doctor prescribed this drug for you, then you go home and say this drug worked miracle. The drug didn't necessarily work in America, but the fact that you tell yourself that, you know,
mind
you're going to be healed, then
it
might not matter sometimes. That's basically all you got to see these things.
So, I'd love to have you come to this meeting in Port Antonio. And I'd like you to consider the possibility that I, as a professor of law at Harvard Law School, and working to some extent with a class that I teach, an evidence class, I have workshop students, and that we work with you on a petition.
Let me bring you back now to another issue that I was dealing with the Blue and Jamco Mountain National Park. This park was established, I think, sometime in the late 80s, early 90s or something like that. I don't remember. Probably. Chances are I wasn't here when it was established anyway. And what they are saying is simply this. Personally, I have no problem with conservation. I have no problem with protecting the protection of endemic species and stuff like that, right? I have no problem with that as far as I am concerned. I don't want anybody to come on my place to shoot birds and things like that. As a kid, I used to do it. But when you grow up, there are some things that you realize that there are some things that are just too precious for you to be
destroying,
you know, wantonly, you know. Now, the treaty with our foreparents and the British colonial government at that point in time is that the Maroons could hunt anywhere they want in the forest within a 3-mile limit of any settlement. And each settlement would have meaning plantations and, you know, something like that. Now, when you go in, let's say the Blue Mountain or the Jamco Mountain from here, And you're not talking about 3 miles as the crow fly, but 3 miles and land.
Yeah.
You know, where you have to walk winding and stuff like that. You have a vast amount of area to hunt, to gather wood, to do everything without you getting to this 3 mile radius of any settlement.
Yeah.
So when the park was established, the fact that this treaty was there for over 250 years before this one came into being, and nobody, as far as I know, had said, well, look, an agreement had to be between two people, because an agreement can be between one person, right? It must be between two, and one of the signatures to this agreement decided that I am going to unilaterally change the agreement without consulting the other one. Then you're bound to have a problem down the road.
Yeah.
You're bound to have a problem. Because whereas they're saying, okay, you mustn't hunt the coney because it is in danger, or the black-billed parrot or whatsoever. That to me, it makes sense in the fact that it is in danger. But at the same time, how do you treat the situation when somebody who have this agreement and you never tell him that you change the rules and he never agreed to your changing the rules, when you go out and hunt and he catches a pony and he shoots a black-billed parrot, what can you do to him?
You have to let him know the law change.
No, how are you going to let him know the law change? Did he agree with you to change the law?
No, that's the next thing.
You alone take a decision. And he was a part of the original agreement. No, that to me.
Is that what's happened?
That is what,
with the park?
That is what happened. We don't have a running with them. We never had a running with them.
And, but you've lost your right to hunt up there?
As far as I am concerned, nobody loses any right to hunt anywhere.
No, but you still have the right.
I mean, theoretically, we have the right. It's something that, if it comes to where it has to be tested in a court of law, then that is where the problem will be.
Uh-huh.
Because the fact is, I did not know, and the former colonel never told me that they have rescinded or said that they are in agreement to this setting up. Because when the government was going to set up, and about to set up the park down in a compound town area in the Cockpit country, I was going to they hire a consultant from the United States. The gentleman I know very well, he was living here with us doing his thesis and, you know, music and ethnical music and the Maroon culture and everything like that, Dr. Ken Bilby. And he came to me, we sat outside there and it's a good thing. When he came today, the captain was here with me and my father was here with me. And I think the major was here. I don't remember what we were doing, but somehow or the other we were all right here and we discussed and he asked me about the problem and things that we have here in regulation to the park and how they should proceed, you know, in setting up that one down there, knowing that it's gonna encompass the Maroon area again as well. Well, I explained to him as best as I could what I knew about the park and the setting and how it is and the restriction that they have. But that, as I know it now, is causing a problem in the Cockpit country. Because the Maroon is in a compound town, want to have more say in the whole thing. And they are defending their land, which I don't blame them. Because when the original treaty was to be signed between themselves, or, you know, and the British. The British started out with trickery in the first place. 15,000 acres of land ended up being 1,500 acres of land. You see, when you negotiate something in the bush, and you are not able to read and write,
yeah,
or at least not read to read and write English, then somebody come and they say, okay, they write a document and tell you that this is what is on the document. You can say, well, you're going to get 100 gallon of water, but in actual fact it is 10 there. But you sign here, make your mark here. Because he tells you it is 100, but it's actually 10 written on the paper.
Yeah.
and you make your mark there. The only rule you can always say that you have read it to your head and said 10 and you agree to it. But you are not going to negotiate for 100.
Well, one of the things that we might talk about profitably on Sunday is the way in which taking a position on something that stimulates debate actually increases visibility and power of the group. If, for example, let's imagine success, let's just tell the story of success and see if it's plausible. If, for example, this petition on marijuana were to be seen as interesting and a little bit of humor in it, but actually making a very serious point, and something that people are invited to sign up for, and I read it and I say, hell, I can sign up for that, and I can sign up through the internet or through lots of other ways. And so in fact there's a whole nation of people that wind up signing a petition on behalf of the Maroons. Then the next thing the Maroons want, they get the door open when they walk in the room. They say, oh, let me talk to you about something else. It's like, okay, I know who you are now. You're the guy that did that last one. Would you mind if I took your picture?
Okay.
You have a totally beautiful smile. When it really breaks out, it's really something. It's like one of these light up the room jobs.
I see what you're saying. Okay, here we go.
Okay, now you're good. All right, pretty good. All right, excellent. So, tell me a little bit about yourself. You were born here?
Yes.
And where'd you grow up?
Here.
Right here? Uh-huh. And that's been your story? You've been here since you started?
No, in actual fact, I spend a little time, I would say outside of Jamaica, but I spend a little time going in and outside of the United States in terms of what I was doing. I used to work on a cruise ship for a while, and we used to sail from out of Miami every Saturday. I did that for like 9 years, sailing from Miami, nearly every when I'm on vacation. And in the beginning, for the first year and 3 months, when I leave Jamaica, because I left in 84, I never returned until 85, so I spent like 1 year and 3 months there, right? And then I went back out, and I did a 9 month contract, because then by then we just start to regularize the whole thing and then we have a contract for 9 months, right? So I think I came to Jamaica within that 9 months about 3 times. And then we went back to work again because we were going like the eastern side of the Caribbean from Miami down to Puerto Plata in the Dominican Republic to US Virgin Island and to Puerto Rico. And then we start to come to the western side of the Caribbean, where we would go to Cozumel, to Grand Cayman and Jamaica. And we will alternate maybe 1 week on this side, 1 week on this side, and
So you really get to see the territory.
Yeah, you get to see the territory. And I did that like for 9 years, and then the company, they sold the ship that we were working at, and they had some other ships, so they transferred some of us to go and work on the other ship. And it was like from...
Right.
Yes, what man? It was like from, we were sailing from New Orleans now, down to Mississippi, Cozumel, Grand Cayman, and Jamaica, and then back up. So I did that like for 2 years. Now the company, they sold the ship again, more or less.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, okay, fine. I don't think I want to be sailing any longer. So I came back home and it was when I came back home that at the time, that would be in 95. Then Colonel decided to... Well, in actual fact, I came home in April and he had relinquished the position since January. The council at the time had said, well, they would... The major would be in charge until another year or so. until they probably think they can have an election to have somebody. So I was home in April, and you know, people asked me about it, and I said, well, I'm not too keen, and I'm not necessarily all that interested in it, because probably I thought that I would probably still go back to work in a shape and things like that. But then, you know, people still come and ask, and I said, well, okay, if you say so, let me see what I can do. So I decided that, okay, fine, I'll enter the race and see how it goes. And we had meetings. All this time I would have attended all the meetings that were kept and things like that. And before that, I was always at the meetings, in the township meetings and things like that, when I'm here. And then we had an election. It was just two of us who were going for the post, and I played, and myself. Well, I won overwhelmingly, and that was in September of 95. Never since I've been independent. So I have been in Jamaica all of that time, from 95 until now, save and except for last year, July. Yeah, I went to England last year, July. I spent 1 month. I went because of the death of my wife. So I went up there. She was buried there. So I came back. I just spent 1 month there, and then I came back. Because I didn't want to stay in the family that I was. And as a result of that, we had two children, my wife and I. And I left those two children in England because, not that it would be difficult for me to take care of them here, but their grandmother, you know, asked me to let them stay. So I tell them I'll think about it. It took a long time for me to really come to a conclusion that I would leave in there. And I asked them, you know, the children, what is it that they want? You know, they were saying that they want to stay in England, because as a matter of fact, when I called my little son before I went up there, he told me that he was going to stay, he was coming back. So I asked him, well, who told you that you are going to be staying in England? He said, well, his grandmother. I said, no, your grandmother never told you that. Your grandmother never told you that. You know, but what his grandmother actually said is that if I agreed for them to stay, then, you know, but, yeah. So I took them aside when I was there, you know, and we sat in the room, and I said to them, well, look, the decision is for me to make. And they were saying that. My dad said, well, Daddy, you know, you never listen to us. That's what we want to do. Said, well, that might be so. That probably might be so in the past. But the thing is, any decision that I make now is what I would have to live with. And you don't have any decision in this process. This is for me and me alone to make. You have nothing to say. But at the end of the day, you know, after I came back home and they had actually went there to spend their vacation, in the summer vacation with their grandmothers. And unfortunately, my wife died from what you call pulmonary embolism, thrombosis, you know, long flight from Jamaica to England. And probably not moving around enough. You have a blood clot, you know, that come up on black lungs. So, I think everything was okay until the plane landed. Because when I spoke to my daughter, I communicated with my sister-in-law, who was on the flight with them. So, that's my wife, younger sister. She's a nurse. A public health nurse in Jamaica. And it was like 6 or 10 going. My wife and two kids, she and two other, a niece and a nephew and a cousin. So when what my doctor actually told me is that when the plane landed, and my wife had to take down the luggage from the overhead compartment, at the time that she collapsed, and then I had to come out to the work and add it, and then fall down. So they tried to resuscitate her, but then you see the problem is, if you are black, and you are in England, and you come on and hear Jamaica flight, which is coming from Jamaica, and something like that happened to you, the first thing comes to mind is that you have swallowed drugs.
Oh boy, yes, of course.
So I do not think that, based upon what was told to me by mother, and I didn't want to question them too much. So, because you can well imagine watching their mother dying in front of their eyes is not something that they want to keep repeating. It's something they want to forget sooner or later. Impossible as it is, anyway. So, you know, when I listen to what they say, and to, you know, my sister-in-law, I said to myself, okay, enough is enough. I've heard enough. I don't want to hear anymore. Because I think that, you know, probably not listening to the story anymore might be a better way to deal with the situation. And then again, as if she's dead is a big enough problem as it were. But then the question of where I should bury her was another problem. Because most of the people here were saying that bring her by the back and bury her here. Someone's saying, okay, fine, you go there and bury her, she's already dead, she's there and there. And then I had to weigh all of these things, right? Whether I should have buried her here or buried her there in England. So I came to the conclusion that everything is rest on me as the husband to make the final say. Anything that I say would have to be. But then I took her mother into consideration